Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today is an environmentalist, author, and entrepreneur who was awarded a congressional commendation as well as recognition by Time magazine as a hero of the environment in 2009. In that year, Kasson Trenor and two co-founders created the world's first sustainable sushi restaurant. He is author of a number of books on environmentalism and sustainable seafood, like his reference guide on sustainable sushi, and now a children's book, Imiju, The Wondrous Tale of a Curious Girl and Her Journey Under the Sea, a book about ocean conservation and responsible food systems. After receiving a BA in political science, Kasson Trenor received a chef certificate in classical French cuisine. Then in 2009, he went to work at Greenpeace as a senior markets campaigner. His positions at Greenpeace were aimed at improving the oceans and the fishing industry. Last month, the California State Senate passed a resolution acknowledging his work. He's been featured in Time, Forbes, The New York Times, and CNN, and delivered TED Talk on a new paradigm for contemporary activism. Kasson Trenor, welcome.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You look too young to have accomplished all you've done.
I try to get a lot of sleep.
Well, you have just received, the last couple of weeks?
Yeah.
This award from the California State Senate.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was just a week and a half ago. It was a really invigorating experience to have that kind of commendation.
Besides the others that you had received, well, how did you get interested in environmentalism?
I grew up in a little town in Washington State, and just a few steps away from the beach. And when I was little, that beach and my experience of that beach was a big part of my life. And I had the unfortunate experience over the course of my life of watching that beach change as I grew in some pretty negative ways because of development and pollution and things like that in Puget Sound, to the point that the beach is not a it's not a place where you'd want to catch fish or dig clams anymore like I did when I was little. And I think that did something to me. I think it started a fire and made me realize that I want to do what I can so that other little boys don't lose their beaches to progress the way I did.
Well, you know, I want to brag on our town of Chico in this regard because a friend of mine some years ago saw when bottled water was becoming popular and the trash bins filling up with plastic bottles. And he said, I'm going to make a bottle that's reusable. And he came up with a clean canteen. Another young man, which he happened to know how to work in metal, another young man goes to the dump and sees all these plastic bags flying. He said, we need a reusable bag. And he came up with Chico Bag. So we really are, I say we as a community, I think, behind these kinds of efforts that you have been working on for years yourself.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful to encounter all these people that are so innovative and these places that champion this kind of change. We all need to do this together. I mean, my piece of this is so small, just one piece of this pie, and it's going to take all of us doing all of our parts together to make this change happen.
Well, you mentioned the plastics you see in the ocean, and that's one of the things, this young man who came up with a reusable bag, because the oceans, it's just heartbreaking.
It is.
I mean, aren't on the coast, but we see reports of just these floating islands of plastic.
Yeah, it's a real tragedy. I was out actually in the North Atlantic in May of this year to do some work on the plastic pollution problem. And it was an incredible experience. I was out there with 150 people that were all very dedicated to finding ways to solve this problem. People from the plastic supply chain, people from environmental groups, scientists. I learned so much about the plastic ocean waste issue that we're dealing with, the unmitigated waste streams and the reality of it. And it's going to take all of us working together to get a handle on this. It's a global problem. It's a problem that, despite it being a catastrophe also ironically has the potential to unite us, because it's something that is challenging all of us. If we lose the ocean, what do we have left?
My guest is Cassin Trenor. He is an environmentalist, author, and he was awarded a congressional commendation for his work in environmentalism. How do you, what you bring to this effort, if I want to call it that, what is your angle that is different from what other environmentalists are trying to accomplish?
That's a good question. And I've tried a lot of things. I've been working in ocean conservation for about 15 years. I got my master's degree in 2005 in international environmental policy, focusing on ocean conservation. And since then, I've sort of ping-ponged around in the space trying to find the specific slice of work that I'm best at, that I'm most effective at, that I'm the most passionate about. And it changes, but I've tried a lot of different things. My newest project, Umiju, it's my first time trying to connect with children. And I think there are certainly many environmentalists doing that. And I think it's smart. And so it's why I followed them into this space, because I was given the suggestion way back in 2013, this idea, hey, you know, you are trying to deliver a message that's so heart-driven and so value-based, but you spend so much of your time speaking in a very cerebral context, speaking to adults and trying to convince them. Why don't you talk to children? Why don't you talk to people that are already set up to listen with their hearts and are more in touch and less abashed about their emotions? I thought that was a really interesting idea. I'd never considered it before. I don't have children myself, so I don't really know anything about kids. So it was it was terrifying, to be honest. It was. But it's been a beautiful journey to get into this space and to have the opportunity to speak about ocean conservation and responsible food systems with children, with the people to whom we are leaving this world when we go.
Well, your book is quite striking.
Thank you.
Any children's book, the illustrations are so important because the little ones who can't read are looking at the pictures. And even the cover is designed in such a way that I think, oh, gosh, I spilled water on this book and it's not real water, but it looks real. So how did you get together with an illustrator that did these fantastic illustrations?
So the book is hand-painted by Kaya Koopman, who's a pop surrealist painter based in Santa Cruz. And it was a tremendous piece of work for her to paint this entire book. The book is 72 pages long, if you count all the overleaf.
Which is unusual for a children's book.
It's very unusual, yeah. But it's the reality of the story that we wanted to tell. And it took her a very long time. I found her because she was my favorite artist. I had a print of hers hanging above my desk in my office for years. And I had originally started Umiju with a different illustrator, and that ended up not working out for a number of reasons. And when it fell apart, I was pretty distraught. I was pretty pretty sad. You know, it's a passion project and takes a step backward, and it hurts. So it took me a few months, maybe half a year, just to get back on the horse. But when I did it, I started thinking, you know, who would I like to illustrate this book? And I'm just sitting in my office, and I looked up, and there's the print, and I said, "Wow, I wonder if Kaya would do it." And we didn't really know each other, but I approached her and gave her the manuscript, and yeah.
And she said, "I'm on board with this."
She said it didn't happen quite that fast, but she said, you know, she's like, "I love your story." And little by little, we just started talking about what it would look like for us to work together. And we finally got to a place where we said, okay, let's do this. And that was the end of 2015, beginning of 2016. And here we are, 2019, and the book just came out a few months ago. So it was a long process.
Well, you say it took her 3 years.
It did, yeah.
To paint these to do the illustrations for your book? Because most of them are paintings, and I think there's some pencil.
That's right. Pages. Yeah, all the color illustrations are painted. It's all acrylic on wood panels, and all the black and white is pencil drawing.
Well, describe, since we talked about the cover and directly, describe the cover for the listeners.
Well, the cover is a crop of a piece called Deepest Connection, which is one of the most striking and detailed paintings in the book. And it's a scene when the protagonist, Umiju, who is down in the ocean by this point in the story, is encountering one of the animals that she meets in the ocean. And this one is an octopus. The plot of the story is that Umiju is curious about her relationship with food and her relationship with the ocean. And through this guiding question of what love is, she goes into the ocean and interacts with these different animals that respond to her question in ways that illustrate the realities that are facing our oceans, different challenges and different problems. The octopus is going to talk to her about problems with overfishing and bottom trawling. And it's a really striking image because Kaya did an incredible job of highlighting that curious intelligence that the ocean has in droves, especially in creatures like an octopus that brings so much awareness to the table.
My guest is Cassin Trenor. He is an environmentalist who has written a children's book. And, you know, I almost wanted to introduce you as a poet because your book is written in poetry form, and you did that yourself.
Yeah, it's in verse. It was so scary. I've never really written poetry before. I was warned when I started this project to not do it in poetry, that if it were in prose, it would have a much better chance of selling, it'd be easier to translate, all these things. And I'm sure that's all true, but the book, one of the reasons I did this was because when I think back about why I was fascinated with the ocean when I was little, is because I had children's books that talked about it and about other things that I became fascinated with. And my favorite books, they were all in verse. They were all...
About children's nursery rhymes. Yeah. We can remember them. I can recite nursery rhymes from my childhood because they rhyme.
Exactly. Yeah, they carry you along. They rock you back and forth as you read. I mean, you know...
Which is appropriate for an ocean.
Exactly. Yeah. You think about things like Dr. Seuss and you know, the great children's book writers. And one of the most beautiful parts of their work is the cadence and the rhyme. And I don't have the background or the aptitude to write poetry in any sort of professional way. But the book just, it wanted to come out in verse, and it made it a lot harder to write. It made it take a lot longer. But I'm really happy I did it. I could have written it more quickly in prose, but I think it's a better story in verse. It gave me a lot of opportunity to create more atmosphere.
Well, I was just imagining something that you, because you give presentations, mm-hmm. something that might come up for you. I was once invited to read Dr. Seuss with accompaniment. This guy at the keyboard listened to the rhythm and cadence, and he followed along on the keyboard. And it was just such a delight to actually read the poetry with a musical accompaniment. I could see that for your presentation. If you found a keyboard artist who liked to improvise.
I'd love that.
Wouldn't
yeah.
I think that would be beautiful.
Yeah.
My guest today is environmentalist Cassin Trenor, who has written a children's book. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Cassin Trenor, who has written a children's book about environmentalism and conserving the ocean. Your cover, you mentioned that there's an octopus on the cover, very distinctive sea creature. We can all recognize an octopus, even if we can't name the fishes that are on this cover. And I use fishes on purpose because there was a guy who wrote about fishes and their sensitivity, and he preferred to say fishes because he wanted to us to recognize that they have feelings, and that was the whole point of his book. You may be familiar with Jonathan Balcom.
I read about him when I was reviewing your website. But yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think it's a little bit odd, right, to have a creature whose name is the same word as the verb that means to kill it, right? To fish and fish. I just think that's a bit odd. So fishes works for me.
Well, and you mentioned that she is a surrealist artist, your illustrator, Kaya Koopman. And the young woman who's taking this trip under the sea, she has very blue, the color of water, eyes. And her hair is like water. She illustrated her hair like waves in the ocean. And then there's this sparkle of the water droplets that are on the cover of this book.
Yeah, it's a bit funny talking about a book that's engineered to be so visual on the radio.
Yes.
You have to do a lot of extra work. Yeah.
But there have been ventriloquists on the radio before.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough.
Well, I mentioned we were talking about the fact that you wrote this in poetry form. So would you read a little bit of your poetry for us?
Sure.
You might bring us up to the point that you start to read. And children's books typically don't have page numbers. So
That's right. This is a
few pages into your story where our young lady sits down in her favorite chair. And how does she happen to be, why is she sitting down in this chair?
Well, Umiju's father is a chef, and she has, again, we're right at the beginning of the story. She began the story on the beach, and she has come back home from the beach now, and she's sitting down, and she's about to have a meal that her father is preparing for her.
And then your illustrator has drawn this picture of her father with his knife. And what is he slicing there?
He's slicing up a fish. And it's referenced in the verse. And it creates a framing device for the next step in the story.
Okay, why don't you read a little bit of your poetry?
Sure. Case? She sat down in her favorite chair, a rugged piece of weathered wood that waited there like an old friend across from where her father stood. The fingers of his hand were curled, steady and firm, around his knife, his knobby fist all gnarled up and worn from work and love and life. With shoulders broad like old clay hills and eyes that shone with every chop, her father cut the fish and smiled like sunshine on a mountaintop. He poured them each a cup of tea, and spicy steam spilled out to cloak the plates of fish and honeyed fruit in wisps of twisting dragon smoke. As quick as blinking, Umiju devoured every little bite. Then when she'd had all she could eat, she licked her lips with sheer delight. "Oh, Umiju," her father cried, "that isn't how we celebrate our food, my dear. Slow down and pay respect to what's upon your plate. To eat like that is to ignore that food is more than just a dish. There's time and life and sacrifice behind each bite of rice and fish."
This is environmentalist Cassin Trenor. He's reading from his book, Umiju, The Wondrous Tale of a Curious Girl and Her Journey Under the Sea. And at this point, she's talking to her father. And you know what my favorite line, Cassin, is?
Oh, you have a favorite line?
I do. This is when her father says, "Slow down and pay respect to what's on your plate." Mm-hmm. And when I prepare food, that's my intention. I feel such respect for the food. I happen to be a vegetarian, but and he's cutting up some fish.
He is.
But I love that line where he says, "Slow down and pay respect to what's on your plate."
Yeah, I think it's interesting. The book is based on this question of what it means to love your food. And I think there's a paradox there, because usually when we say that we love food, really what we mean is we just want to eat a lot of it, right? If there's something that we love, whatever dish it is or whatever restaurant you like to go to, you just want to eat it. That's what we mean. But that's not what love is about. And I felt like it's the kind of puzzle that a child could perhaps piece apart more effectively than an adult. And so I thought it was a good framing device for Umiju to explore this idea of what it means to love her food.
I think that might be an unusual idea for a lot of people, but I think if they give it a little thought, they'd realize, yeah, that's quite possible, particularly if we have wonderful farmers markets here in our area.
You do.
And you have a personal connection to the person that grew your food if you don't grow it yourself, which I'm fortunate. Yesterday, I picked the tomato right out of the garden. Still have a scratch on my hand from the cage. And that is such a delight. Mm. To do that. And so whatever the food is, to respect mm-hmm. what that food is. And sometimes if somebody maybe fixes something that I wouldn't normally eat, but they prepare it with respect and love, then whatever it is, I eat it with that frame of mind.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that you have your character in the book saying that. And then on the facing page is Umiji with her cup of tea and the swirls of vapor coming from mm-hmm. the cup. And then there are a pair of eyes down here below.
Yeah. So because Kaya is a surrealist, and one of the reasons that I went to her and was hoping we would be able to work together is because she brings so much fantasy and magic into her work. And again, you know, as a book, This is a book that is competing with screens and things like that for the attention of the younger generation. And I wanted to find a way to make it captivating in every page, every illustration. And at the same time, the ocean is magic. It's close to a literal truth as I can get. it really is. And being able to draw that magic out and instill it into the imagery was something that I really needed from the artist. And Kaya was the perfect person to do it.
My guest is Cassin Trenor, and we're talking about his book, Umiju, A Tale of a Curious Girl and Her Journey Under the Sea. And in this picture that your illustrator has drawn, there she is drinking her tea. And I think maybe the first time through, they don't see these other elements down in the background. And then the second or third time, oh, she's included this mythological creature mm-hmm. here in this illustration. Besides, we recognize kiwi fruit there and some other things in the sketch.
Yeah, there's a lot of detail in the book. There's lots of hidden little secrets. We wanted to create rewards for readers that really wanted to dive into it. In the image that you're looking at right now, dragon tea, which is the image of her drinking the tea, there is that dragon made out of smoke to reflect the verse. There's also dragon fruit here to offer a counterpoint to the dragon. So we did a lot of little things like that to make it funny.
Well, children love to have a book read and read and read mm-hmm. till the parents just think they're going to die if they have to read it again. But children love having stories read and reread. So I can just imagine they're studying, because they're too young for the words, but studying that illustration.
That's what I'm hoping. I still remember the pictures from the books when I was little.
Yeah.
You remember, I mean, the cover from Where the Wild Things Are. I'm never going to forget that picture. You know, some of the images from Dr. Seuss they'll stay with you.
Well, you have, I picked out another reading from your book, several pages over. And this is where young Umiju asks Okatako, "What is love?" Mm-hmm. And we'll have to tell people who Okatako is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Okatako is the octopus that Umiju meets. She meets three different animals, three different helpers, friends in the ocean during her trip. And Okatako is the second one. And her journey in the ocean is about this idea of figuring out what love means. And after she's been counseled by her father that it's maybe something a little different than the way she had been using the word when she had been talking about that she loved food. And Okatako is the second animal, and his response has a lot to do with the fact that he's lost a lot of his friends because of dragging boats, bottom trawling fishing boats that have taken his friends and neighbors away.
I think children can relate to that. If they have to move or a friend has to move and they lose a friend, mm-hmm. that's evokes an emotional reaction, I think.
Yeah.
And so you can do that through your story by having this character lose his friends mm-hmm. because of what we human beings do.
Right, right. Yeah, I think there's something very human about loneliness, very human about a desire for connection. And because the octopus provided that opportunity to bring such a level of intelligence, it made sense for he to be the character that spoke to that.
Well, why don't you read that section of your book, Cassie?
Sure. I have a question for you, too. And as she looked him in the eye, young Umiju asked, Okatako, what is love? And in reply, the creature cocked his head and blinked his moony eyes at Umiju. A riddle to surpass them all, he grinned, his red skin flecked with blue. And sure enough, those long-lost friends of mine can help me answer you. You see those giant ships? Their nets take everything that's in their path. Their endless stomachs never full, while engines roar with greed and wrath. This is not right, this is not good, said Okatako worriedly. Please hear and understand. If those like you do not respect the sea and all it does for you, there will be nothing left for those like me. Love is the missing piece, that sense of empathy, that gentle touch. Love is what we need to keep us safe from those who'd take too much. So when you gaze out at the sea, look deeper than the shore and surf. Consider us that live down here where ocean's belly meets the earth, and see more than a heavy purse and measure more than money's worth.
This is Cassin Trenor, and he's reading from a children's book that he has written. And he is an environmentalist and now poet. You can add poet to
aspiring.
Aspiring poet. Well, I don't know if you could guess what I remember from this page you just read. And this is when she has asked the question, what is love? And he says, love is the missing piece, that sense of empathy, that gentle touch. Love that.
Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to put some words into the book that would trigger the child to ask their parents what it meant, because I felt like it would be a way to capitalize on that organic conversation. You know, a kid is going to maybe not know the word empathy and ask what is empathy, and what a wonderful conversation to have with a child what empathy is, especially in the context of this kind of story.
Yeah, because often our conversation with family members are so superficial and we don't really have that stimulus to talk about the things that are important. Mm. I think children often raise questions that the parents say, oh, golly.
Yeah.
And to ask what is love and that sense of empathy, that gentle touch.
Yeah. The response here around what is love is really, again, it's about just identifying that we don't need to always take as much as we can. We don't always need to have as much as we can, get as much as we can, eat as much as we can. It's about thinking things through with a little bit more empathy about the impacts of what we're doing.
Of the decisions we make.
Yeah, and the decisions with our fork in this case.
And raising those questions when these people are young.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you have another section that I would like for you to read. There's an illustration of a turtle caught in a net on the facing page, and the fish peered at the girl. Imagine if this were your home. And it's heartbreaking to even read that sentence,
Cassin. It's a tough one. So I mean, more and more people are becoming aware of just how grave the problem with ocean plastics is these days. The trash in the ocean is changing the very nature of our planet, changing the chemical makeup of our oceans and impacting not just the animals and plants that live there, but us in turn as we eat them or as we draw on those resources or as we spend time. And it's something that must be arrested. It's something that must be acknowledged. So I did my best to use the third character in the book, which was she's an ancient old anglerfish, lives very down very deep in the ocean. And Umiju is speaking to her again, trying to figure out what love means in this context. And she answers her in a way that's talking about the impacts of trash and dumping in the ocean.
Would you read that section, Cassie?
Of course. The fish peered at the girl and said, "Imagine if this were your home and someone came and dumped their trash all over everything you own. See, me and mine, we find ourselves awash in this unwanted waste that cascades down from overhead and changes how the ocean tastes. So we abandon in great haste what took us years to put in place. We are connected, you and I," the fish croaked. "And I hope you see that real love cannot exist without responsibility. Remember, even little things you do can harm us down beneath. So just be thoughtful," said the fish, as Umiju gazed out at reefs gone gray and white from poison rain and felt her eyes well up with grief. But just as she began to cry, the current came to stroke her face. It wiped her tears away and sent them gently drifting into space where they combined with rolling waves that vanished out into the blue while whispering a simple truth that echoed back to Umiju. Just as her tears were salt water, she was a drop of ocean too.
I might remind people, this is Cassin Trenor reading from his book, Umiju, The Wondrous Tale of a Curious Girl and Her Journey Under the Sea. And the illustration shows these creatures that live there, but also some things that don't belong in the ocean that we put there. There are a couple of lines that I liked in this section of your book. "Imagine if this were your home and someone dumped trash."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
there's that empathy for these creatures that live under the sea and we're trashing their home.
That's right. Yeah.
And then I like this line too. "Real love cannot exist without responsibility."
Mm-hmm. That's another trigger phrase. I'm hoping that phrase allows for a conversation around what it is to be responsible and what that means. It's a word with a lot of different applications, and I hope that there's a conversation there.
Well, I think, too, that sentence applies for children who may have never see the ocean mm-hmm. or go under the water, but they may have a pet, a dog or a cat that they love. But that love doesn't exist without responsibility. You have a responsibility to that creature.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, it's why I was trying to put the information in earlier when she was talking with the octopus about how just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. And part of this responsibility is remembering that our actions go far beyond the limits of our vision.
My guest is Cassin Trenor, and he has written a children's book on environmentalism and sustainable seafood. His book is Imiju, The Wondrous Tale of a Curious Girl and Her Journey Under the Sea. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Cassin Trenor, who has written a children's book in poetry form. It's about a young girl's trip under the sea. There's another section of your book. This is a few pages over. And this time you have another sea creature who looks somewhat like an octopus, but I don't think this is an octopus.
No, this is a little strawberry squid, a little deep sea squid that Kaya wanted to paint.
So would you read this section?
Sure. This is in the third section. This is after Umiju has come out of the ocean, and it's sort of the recap of the story and her internalizing the information that she's received. Like waking from a restful sleep, now Umiju could clearly see there were no monsters in the deep, just neighbors, friends like you and me that share our home under the sun and need us all to recognize how much we are two parts of one. So easily seen with open eyes. Her journey had taught her so much, and Umiju had come to know the many ways that humans touch those creatures living down below, how to live softly up above, and what it really means to love. She'd heard the fish she first met say that nature isn't flawed or wrong and can't be fixed or locked away, for caged birds sing much sadder song. She thought of Okatako then, who'd said to just take what you need and not let others' homes and friends be wiped away by thoughtless greed. The ancient one who'd lost her name told Umiju to please be kind, for sometimes love can be the same as keeping others' needs in mind. And those who build community let go of I and start from we.
This is environmentalist Cassin Trenor reading from his book, Umiju. The Wondrous Tale of a Curious Girl and Her Journey Under the Sea. A couple of things I wrote down that I liked about this section, Cassin. We are two parts of one.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned what it really means to love.
Mm-hmm. These are the two main themes of the book. I mean, the book, it pretends to be about the ocean. You know, because that's what I work on and it's what I know and it's what I love. But it's not really about the ocean. It's really about harmony. It's about relationships and how when two things that are work together and that are so balanced like this come together, it creates something greater than the sum of its parts. This idea of one and one making three, you know, this new and greater thing. And that's, I think that's what I really tried to get across, and the kind of thing that I think kids will understand even better than any of us, you know?
Because if you watch media, I mean, I watch the news, and the reports in general seem to be about anger, about miscreants, about the opposite of your message about love. And there are some programs who tell stories that are just so heartwarming. Mm-hmm. And I just wish, I wish we could have more stories like this. But of course, you've heard, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of stories that grab our attention. And your message is a soft one. And so you have to kind of, if I may say so, grab our attention with this story to give us a lesson about love.
Yeah, I mean, Nancy, I'm as guilty as anyone with the bleeds it leads approach. I've spent a lot of my career trying to take a very alarmist approach to this because I believe that the issues around our ocean need our attention immediately. And I've tried a lot of tactics that really do that, spotlighting the problem. And I just, I've come to believe that there's something to be said about using beauty and art to tell stories about potential and getting away from focusing on conflict and recognizing that there's so much that can be done with a heart-driven tale.
Another thing I wrote down from this last section you just read, the Ancient One told Umiju to please be kind. Mm-hmm. Let go of I and start from we.
Yeah, I think the community lesson is critical, this idea that so much of the pain in this world, so many of the problems in this world, I think can be traced back to, at the end of the day, somebody starting their appraisal of a situation with the word I. So looking at the situation and saying, how does this relate to me? How can I best benefit? If I can create as many walls as possible between myself and other people, then I could take advantage of this situation in this way. And I do that too. I think it's part of the human experience.
But if you become aware of it, you can change something. If you're not aware of something, you can't change something you're not aware that you're doing. And if you can make us aware, then we can change in a way that we would like to change, I think.
I agree. I mean, yeah.
This word kind told her to please be kind. Mm-hmm. And one of my mottos for myself, my mantra is kinder than necessary. Mm. And I so often in my life encounter people who do that. They go out of their way to show me kindness. And I so appreciate it and try to take my turn at that too. But there's so many people in this world who are willing and able to show kindness.
The vast majority. The vast majority of people in this world are kind, good people that are driven to be kind and good to others. I believe that.
Well, I'm glad you put this in your book that you've addressed to children. Of course, the parents are listening too.
Yeah, I hope so.
And speaking of, you're talking to, say, adults, you gave a TED Talk.
I did.
And what message did you have in your TED Talk?
So I gave my TED Talk, I think in 2012, something like that. It was a while ago. And it was when I was going through some personal changes. I was really starting to question, as I was saying earlier, my sort of more conventional approach to environmentalism, which had been a lot more alarmist and a lot more about focusing on the reality of the problems that are facing us. And I was just changing or flirting with the idea of changing my perspective towards this more beauty-driven and art-driven and value-driven approach. And so my talk was about that. It was about learning how to redefine this idea of activism as something that's not caught up in a mislabel. I think the problem is the idea of activism, right? It's trapped in this word act, which is this very active verb. And really, that's not going to do it. What we need is we need to lead from values that are infused in all of our motions and decisions in any given day. It's not taking one action. It's remembering in all of our little decisions how these things matter and doing the things that we believe are in line with our values. So we don't have to go out and get between, in 2005, 2006, I was down in Antarctica working on anti-whaling ships and getting between the whales and the harpooners, and it was crazy, and I'm glad I did it, and I think it was important. But stuff like that really intense action, I wonder if that would be necessary if we all just made those small value decisions in little everyday occurrences. What am I going to order? Am I going to buy this plastic bottle? Little things like that. We might not have to have the big action.
You know what discourages me, though, Cassin, is that when I try to minimize plastic. If you shop at the food co-op, you reuse, you don't have a lot of trash. You don't generate the trash. But when I'm trying to do my part, I realize, but gosh, this is a drop in the ocean, so to speak.
Yeah.
That other people may not share that value that I have.
Maybe not, but I struggle with this a lot too. This idea that the problem is so big and I'm so small.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes about, I was real privileged to have a dear, dear friend, still have a dear, dear friend whose stepfather was a well-known folk singer. This guy, his folk singer, his name was Utah Phillips. He's a great man. He passed away several years ago. But he had this way of interpreting the world, and it was a beautiful thing. He'd have these shows where you sing a song and you tell a story, sing a song, tell a joke. It's this big, convivial, beautiful evening. And he had all these little quotables, these little snips that he would throw out. And he had one that has given me so much strength over the years. He used to say, "There are too many good people doing too many good things for me to afford the luxury of being pessimistic." And that has gotten me out of bed on more days than I can say. Because, yeah, sometimes it feels like, what can I do? There's so many problems in the world, and all I can do is decide whether or not to buy this bottled water. But there are so many people that are doing what they can. Every crisis out there, every problem out there is firing up more and more people that are passionate about taking that on. And, you know, I'll just say this to you. Knowing that you, Nancy, are down here in Chico making the decision to not buy that bottled water, that helps me up in Washington. And I hope you know you can count on me up in Washington making decisions in line with those values too. And I hope that helps you.
Well, As I said, I'm really proud of our community. I think Chico, and I speak for Chico, that's where we are right now, really care and really want to do, if you want to call it, the right thing. Mm-hmm. In fact, the reason you don't live here in Chico, but you have a connection to Chico through a restaurant here.
That's right. Yeah, there's a wonderful little sushi bar here in Chico called Aonami that ever since they opened has really embraced the idea of finding a way to meld the cuisine with sustainability and environmental ethics, which is really similar to in 2008, my partners and I opened a sustainable sushi restaurant, the first one out there. And we were approached relatively soon by the gentleman here in Chico who said, "Hey, I want to do something like this. I believe in what you're doing." And he's been up here running that business and making people happy for 10 years. And it's wonderful. You know, he does so many beautiful dishes with sustainable seafood, so many beautiful vegan dishes. There's, you know, I don't necessarily subscribe to any one idea that there's a perfect diet for a person or a planet. But I do believe that we can all make good choices aligned with our ethics. So I think it's beautiful that he offers so many ways to do that.
Well, since your book is about the ocean, you may have noticed in his restaurant, he has this painting, a rather famous one, of this big ocean wave.
That's right.
Yeah. On his wall.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that's maybe ties it all together, right? That's the beauty of art. That's what art can do when it's melded with activism, is it can bring us, even if we're in a place like Chico where we're very far away from the ocean, it can bring us there. And it can remind us that we are connected and that it does matter and that our choices make a difference and that we're all in this together, us and the fish and the animals and the other people on the street.
Well, I want to go back to the fact that you have won various awards. Mm. And for example, you were awarded a congressional commendation. And what in particular brought you to their attention to give you this commendation?
I was awarded a congressional commendation for environmental leadership, again, specifically within sustainability in the sushi industry. I've had a lot of opportunity and I've had a lot of help creating this real vanguard in that space and helping chefs step up and do things better in that industry. The sushi industry is very destructive. It hasn't always been that way, but after it started to globalize in about the 70s and 80s, it really became a problem, and it continues to be a huge problem. And it's hard. It's hard for a sushi chef to make the changes necessary to operate a restaurant that actually has a positive impact on the ocean. But they're out there, these chefs and restaurateurs and operators that want to do right by the planet and want to not only preserve the ocean but preserve the cuisine that they love. And so it's been a blessing for me to be able to be a little part of that transformation.
Well, you actually have a background in being a chef yourself.
Yeah,
it was French cuisine,
that's
quite
true.
Different.
That's
but
true.
That must have been helpful, that background as a chef. So when you approach a chef, you aren't just coming as some outsider necessarily, but you have a background as a chef.
That's true. I I spent enough time in kitchens, cooking on lines, and culinary school to understand that I have no business cooking on lines. But it did help me understand the realities of the restaurant industry and the pressure and the difficulty and the slim little margins that they operate under. And it's hard to make changes in those spaces, but it's no excuse. We still have to. I mean, at the end of the day, anyone that's selling seafood, they're taking their paycheck from the ocean, and it's our responsibility. I'm one of those people. It's our responsibility to take care of the ocean for those that come into our restaurants.
Well, there's one other award that I wanted to remind people that you were received recognition by Time Magazine as a hero of the environment. Oh, this is in 2009.
That was incredibly humbling. It was a really wonderful thing. We got the notice from Time Magazine, and it was a beautiful moment. They came in and they shot the restaurant and they interviewed us, and We were so honored. You know, we were just this little shoebox restaurant at the time, 26 seats, this little place, and they had found out about us and what we were doing, and they valued it. They understood why we were trying so hard. And sometimes that kind of validation, it's what you need to put the next step, your foot in front of the other again, you know? And it was for us. We were able to open several more restaurants after that. We were able to help a lot of other chefs who came in looking for ways to activate sustainability in the sushi industry and in, you know, bring more vegan dishes to the table and stuff like that. And it was beautiful. They made a huge difference, not just for us, but for the sustainable sushi movement as a whole.
Well, I want to add my appreciation to the work that you do, Cassin.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Cassin Trenor is author of Umiju, The Wondrous Tale of a Curious Girl and Her Journey Under the Sea. And this book is aimed at children, but adults will benefit from reading this also. So Cassin is an environmentalist, an author, a poet, and hero.
Oh.
Thank you, Cassin.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It was a pleasure being here.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.